My name is Lisa Highwood. I'm the CEO and founder of the Tiki Highwood Foundation in Zimbabwe. So it's my first time in the Isle of Man, which is very exciting.
Excellent.
coming from Zimbabwe, it's quite a trip, but I've set up the foundation in memory of my late father 32 years ago, 1994. And our process was to work with authorities in Zimbabwe, protecting species that were on the verge of extinction. The foundation actually was launched off the first ever bull elephant translocation, which was very exciting. And it was the first time elephants had ever been moved from one place to another. Zimbabwe had undergone a tremendous drought in 1992-93. And that's when family groups of elephants had been moved, but no one had actually ventured into moving bull elephants. So that was what launched the foundation in 1994, was the first ever bull elephant translocation.
And that in itself is an amazing thing to do. I mean, translocating any species is difficult, but I imagine a sort of large species like a bull elephant must have a huge amount of challenges.
Well, it did. And you can imagine all those years back, the technology was not what it is today. And so we got really excited when there were 25 people that it took to move one elephant. Whereas today you kind of need three people, a crane, a helicopter, and a flatbed to move them. And you know, it's much easier now. But yeah, in the old days it was labor intensive. So the world's come a long way when it comes to translocation of elephants. But what happened to me was that I realized that a lot of people around the world are really aware of elephants and they are there to save and help the plight of the elephants. In Zimbabwe, our elephant population is not on the verge of extinction or even threatened. We've got a very, very healthy, strong population. So I didn't want to kind of reinvent a wheel. I wanted to do something that was incredibly meaningful and something that wasn't being done. And species that are very threatened in Zimbabwe are invariably not known about. So one of the rarest animals in Zimbabwe is actually the Lichtenstein hartebeest, which is a very big antelope, about 160 kg antelope. And in the early days, there were less than 46 left in our entire country.
Wow.
So that was the first really meaningful endangered species activity that we got involved in. And I think the rest is kind of 30 years of history. From the Lichtenstein, it kind of verged into species such as the pangolin.
And we'll come to the pangolin in just one second. I was just going to ask one thing, which was, I dare say a lot of people do know about elephant and elephant plight, and certainly on this side of the world, I think they feel that elephant populations everywhere are under severe threat. But in Zimbabwe, you're saying they hold up well. Is this conservation efforts, protection, or?
100%. No, Zimbabwe is, I would definitely strongly support the fact that Zimbabwe is a forerunner in conservation and has been for many, many years, long before even my time. And I think Botswana also has a good, strong population, as does South Africa. So Zimbabwe, you know, we've always focused on species like elephant and, you know, our national parks. You can't pretty much go to any national park without seeing elephant. So it is. It's definitely a kudos to the management structure within that country.
And then you mentioned there the pangolins, which I think is certainly the sort of crux of your talk here on the Isle of Man, protecting the pangolins. And this is one of the most trafficked, if not the most trafficked mammal globally. But as you just suggested there beforehand, I dare say, again, over in this part of the world, you say pangolin to people and their eyebrows raise. I know I mentioned to a couple of people and someone said, is it a fish? And yeah, I mean, it's incredible that it is so endangered and so widely trafficked and yet so little known globally.
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest problems that we face with the pangolin, is that nobody knows what it is. And they either say, is it a reptile? Is it a penguin? And I think that's always the first step when you're trying to save a species, is you've got to get people to understand the importance and relevance of this species in the ecosystem. You know, I will always refer to the pangolin as the protector of the earth because of how they are and the fact that they've been here for over 80 million years. So for me, it's not the fact that you have to be charismatic, majestic and iconic. It's, you know, all of us have relevance. It doesn't matter what race we are, what sex we are, we all have relevance. And the same in the animal world for me is everything has relevance. And those that are not or don't have a big light shone on them, I think that's where an organization such as Tiki Highwood Foundation comes in, because we want to shine a light, and we have for the last 32 years on this particular species. Not because we set out to do it, but because we realized that there was such a tremendous need.
So can you, it might be a challenge this one, can you describe a pangolin for someone, as you say, a lot of people think, no idea. Can you describe what a pangolin is like?
Okay, so I'm going to kind of verge more onto the anthropomorphic description than the scientific description.
That'll do fine.
Okay. So a pangolin is a very powerful animal. What do I mean when I say that? When you're in the presence of a pangolin, everything stops. Time is frozen. There wouldn't be such traditional and cultural reverence behind this species if there wasn't something unbelievably special. And it's very difficult to try and get that across to people that have never seen a pangolin or never been in the presence of a pangolin. But they have such unbelievable wisdom. They are a mammal. The way that they nurture their young when it's born is it will blow you away. They actually hold them in their arms, the ground pangolin, and obviously breastfeed. And they nurture that pup by keeping it safe. They roll around the pup. So you don't really have another species in the kingdom, the animal kingdom, that takes care of that baby to that extent. They are fairly territorial, particularly the males, and they have a very soft underbelly. There are four species of pangolin in Africa, and there are four species of pangolin in Asia. So with all four species of pangolin, in fact, all eight species of pangolin, they have got scales that kind of start just above their nose, and they go all the way down their body, all their tail. Their underbody is either bare, so ground pangolins have a completely naked stomach, as does a giant pangolin, and then the two arboreal pangolins have fur underneath their bellies, but their scales are there to basically offer their protection, and the scales are their armor, which is why our logo is armored but still need protection.
Absolutely. And do they, if they are under attack, then do they do the thing like maybe hedgehogs do on the Isle of Man, where they curl up and rely on their outer protection?
100%. The minute a noise or anything happens, a pangolin will quickly go into a very defensive ball. And it's that round ball that they've curled up into, which is their defense mechanism. And that, with the scales, that's their armor, so that things can't bite them. But however, man can pick them up. And
that makes it rather easy for poaching.
All eight species are on Appendix 1 of the CITES Convention, meaning that it has the utmost protection and it cannot be traded. Which is key to understand. And that only came into effect in 2017. So that was one of the first journeys that the Tiki Howard Foundation played a role in, is to try and make sure that we could elevate the status of the pangolin in order to create awareness for the species. And you are 100% correct. It is the most trafficked mammal on the planet, which is a terrible title to have.
Yeah. And it is, just again, while we're on this, I assume we were talking about the native predators it has, the pangolin has in nature, but I assume, like most things in nature, just the natural predators wouldn't actually upset the ecosystem. It's only really when man comes out and starts taking out these huge numbers, that's when the trouble starts.
100%. Absolutely. Nature knows how to take care of nature. We're the ones that create the imbalance.
And it is incredible. I've never seen one, I'm afraid, yet. I'd like to. I've never, I think, seen one in the flesh, as it were. I've seen videos and obviously pictures of them, and it's an incredible species, again, when you see them, because you wouldn't think from your description there, they have a, would it be fair to say, they have a sort of slightly prehistoric look about them in many ways. Are they a species which, a bit like sort of, you know, alligators and sharks, have they altered very little down the eons?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question. Definitely they look prehistoric, and out of all the different species. So you've got the ground pangolin, which is what we have in Zimbabwe. And that, so they have two little back legs, like little elephant pads, and they walk on their back legs. And they, you know, it's that little Chinaman walk where they bob, bob, bob. And I think that gives them very much a prehistoric feel to them. And that dome of their back, I think, gives that prehistoric dinosaur look. You've then got, in Western Central Africa, you've got the boreal species, which is your white-bellied pangolin and your black-bellied pangolin. And then you've also got your giant pangolin. So we have a facility in Cameroon, and a month ago we rescued our first giant pangolin in Cameroon, which was an unbelievable experience. This pangolin is 31 kgs. You can imagine an animal covered in armor that's 31 kgs. It took three of us to actually carry the pangolin and move the pangolin around. So they have adapted to the life where we are today, and what they eat is makes them incredibly specialized. So they only eat ants and termites, and everything that they require they can get from the earth if we left them alone. So man is their biggest threat from poaching and trafficking, but they also have some natural enemies, if I can call it that. So what we find with the work that we do in Zimbabwe is your honey badger. We don't like honey badgers coming anywhere near pangolin because of their tenacity and their determination. They will just keep going at the pangolin, and they can break through the underbelly, and they will try and get that pangolin. You've also got hyena, which is a threat to pangolin. Lions, not so much. Leopards is another one. And then obviously in your western central countries, your birds of prey affect the pangolin as well, because the small arboreal species, the biggest white-bellied pangolin we've worked with is just under 3 kgs, and then you've got your little black-bellied pangolin, and they're tiny. They're not going to get beyond 2 kgs. And if you think about those weights for the pangolin, you can imagine if we took a white-bellied pangolin, let's say an average of say 2.1 kgs. Now that entire body is 2.1 kgs. So if you were to take all the scales off, which is what's traded, you might only get 400-odd, 600-odd grams. So when you hear seizures of tons of pangolin scales in Hong Kong or in Nigeria, you can only imagine what volumes of pangolins have been massacred in order to reach a ton of pangolin scale. And that's what I think a lot of people can't fully appreciate, is the magnitude of this trafficking. And, you know, a species such as a pangolin cannot keep up with these figures. They only have one pup on average a year. We've just been able to confirm that the white-bellied and the ground pangolin have twins, but it's very, very rare. I mean, we've only seen one female with twins in Cameroon and one female with twins in Zimbabwe. So that's not your average. They have one pup. So how can the figures of tonnage of trafficked scales, you know, there are not enough animals on the ground to support those.
So who is actually trafficking the scales, and why? Because it sounds like on this scale, it sounds like it's an organised business to a degree, albeit an illegal one. And my understanding is that the sort of scales are going into traditional medicines, by and large?
100%. So your traditional Chinese medicine is your biggest factor that is at play here. You know, I think what might be important to add at this moment is that for all traditional Chinese medicine, there has not been any scientific proof that the over 400 uses of pangolin scales within the pharmacopoeia of the Chinese base actually can cure whatever it might be, whether it's arthritis or eczema. There's no proof. So that's terrifying, number one. Number two, for every traditional Chinese medicine used using a mammal, so whether it's a seahorse, bear bile, whatever it might be, there is a botanical substitute. That means that no animal actually has to lose its life within their own cultural system. But that's not the case on the ground. And then you have to add that with the volume of people that have been brought up with this tradition, this ancient tradition. It's a lot to have to face and try and deal with.
And so, yeah, it sounds like a sort of double-edged sword here, because you're obviously having to deal with the poaching and the trafficking and the killing of the animals on the ground, at least the illegal collecting of them. And then there's also an educational aspect here, because as you say, the problem is, I suppose, particularly within, as you say, ancient Chinese medicines, it's very deeply rooted in the culture there, that people genuinely believe these things are going to cure them.
Absolutely. But you have to start somewhere. I mean, I think, you know, many years ago, witches were burnt at the stake. Mm. We're not there anymore. So you've got to change thought process. And I think that's where we are currently. And there are many organizations globally that are fighting to try and bring the modernization of where we are. You know, there's lots of animals. There's tiger bones, there's lion bones, there's bear bile, there's shark fin soup and all the things that sharks can do. So there's lots of things that are wrapped up. It's not just the pangolin. I think where the pangolin kind of got a little bit lost in the hype is they're small. They don't have teeth. So you don't need a weapon. You don't need a vehicle. You don't need a chainsaw to cut the tusks out. You know, it's a very easy animal to traffic. And I think that's why it's silently been slipping towards the brink of extinction because it's been so easy.
And I assume it's still in the same camp. You mentioned a few bear, bile and tusks. And I was thinking again of something like rhino horn, which is still illegally trafficked and I think highly valued in Chinese cultures. And as far as I understand, they probably both have the same main constituents, mostly keratin, a bit like chewing your fingernails.
Exactly. It is. But, you know, when you come from a different culture, and we have to be respectful. I think it doesn't matter what your background is and what your culture or religion or belief system is. We have to, as a one planet, we have to be respectful of one another. But it's got to work both ways. And I think the fact that it's well known that there are there's no scientific proof that these over 400 potential cures using pangolin scale has worked, there must be a substitute now that must be adopted. And I think that's where working with governments is so important, because the government has the power to say yes or no. And, that's, we can all on the ground and as a population, we can all talk about things and we can all understand things and we can try and strive to get more recognition and awareness for these species. But at the end of the day, it's the governments at play that are the ones that will say, I understand this and I'm going to change it. Governments make change, and we can see that in the world that we live in currently.
And did I read that the meat is also traded as well illegally?
Yes, it is. It's a delicacy and it's very special. Apparently it tastes like sweet chicken. They call it sweet meat in Cameroon. So that's one of our biggest problems in West Africa, is that the byproduct of the pangolin being eaten, which is the scales in West and Central Africa, that's what's going to the traditional Chinese medicine. But it's actually the local people that are eating pangolins because it's sweet meat. And when we started working in Cameroon, it was horrendous. You know, you'd say, well, who hasn't eaten a pangolin? Because you've got to take it at face value that everybody has eaten a pangolin at some point in their lives. Southern Africa, we don't have that. It's not a common thing to eat pangolin in Southern Africa. But in West and Central Africa, everybody eats pangolin. So you've got to also try and change that mentality of, no, this is not a meat that you can eat anymore. And again, that's going to have to come from the governments. The governments are the ones that need to put in the implementation of saying, this is wrong, this is the law that we have of our land, and then enforce it. And that's key. So, you know, there's so many tools that you need in that conservation toolbox in order to have an impact.
Would it be possible, and again, this is often goes into fairly controversial territory, but in some of these meats, and we're thinking again maybe things like alligators or crocodile, where the meat is eaten, the skin is used in products like boots and handbags and such like, would it be possible to farm the animals legally so that the wild population would then be protected and would thrive?
It's a good question. And if I can take, if I can answer it in two phases. Okay, so number one, the way the pangolin is, i.e. it only has one young, potentially a year, whereas a crocodile lays a clutch of eggs. Mm-hmm. So you can't put farming of crocodiles versus farming of pangolins in the same bracket, because you only get one young a year. Okay, so economically, it's not viable. So I think it's a horrendous thought. I don't think we should farm any species, to be very open and honest with you. But if I take my emotions out of it...
No, exactly. There's okay, an ethical issue as well.
Yes,
as a, yeah.
Okay. So we take all the ethical out and the welfare out, and we just look at it on an economic base. Okay, so economically, to get pangolins to breed and to have an F1 or F2, which is the one that you'd be able to eat or use the scales for, mm-hmm. It costs too much to get to that point, okay, because it's a very specialized species. There have been zoos over the ages that have tried to do this, and it's cost them millions of dollars just to keep the pangolins in captivity. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, why would we want to do this, is my question I always ask. Why would we want to perpetuate something that doesn't have any scientific background saying this works? Why should it be a discussion on the table? It shouldn't. There's no proof. This is where we are. This animal's endangered. It's been ridiculously trafficked. This needs to be the solution. Adopt it.
So where are we now with the work with the foundation? And obviously here on the Isle of Man, is it something that you're now trying to raise global awareness of the plight of the pangolin, so that obviously, as we all know, if you get enough body, if you get enough mass behind something, that's when it starts to actually have an effect. If enough people start shouting, then things start happening.
Absolutely. And it's key. So my visit here is to create that awareness in the UK. And also, you know, I think having a background and knowing a little bit more about more the UK side as opposed to the Isle of Man, because it's the first time I've ever been here, the British people care. You know, everybody knows that. The British people care. So if more people can care within the space of the world, it's more people behind the battle. So it's very important.
And are you having a good response? Because again, it's always, I think, certainly with any of these protection issues, it's a case of people care more when they can see something. And again, certainly on the Isle of Man locally, we talk about sometimes they protect the seabeds and such like, which obviously, unless you're a diver, you can't see. People always care more if something's tangible in a way. Is that a challenge when you're sort of working at a distance from where the actual species is based?
Yes, I think it is. And I think that's another reason why maybe a visit over here for me has been so important, because we shouldn't have to be able to see or touch something just to know it's important to save it. You know, I love polar bears. I've never seen one, but I'm still going to pick up the banner and try and save polar bears. Same with a seal. Mm. You know, we shouldn't. Where we are right now on a global space, we shouldn't have to see something. We shouldn't have to touch something. You know, I don't believe that animals should be in zoos. I believe we should be protecting our wild spaces so that when we do see an animal, not only is it an unbelievable adventure, but we're seeing that animal in its natural environment doing what it naturally needs to do. These animals that are put into zoos type and facilities, they're not doing what they normally would do. You know, a tiger or a lion pacing in a tiny enclosure, that's not the majestic lion that I would see back home in Zimbabwe. You know, lying under an acacia thorn tree after a good meal with his pride. You know, it. So what are we trying to teach the next generation? Are we trying to say still that it's okay to have animals in cages? I think we need to break out of that space as well. We need to save the green spaces. That's what we need to do.
Would you accept it? Because again, this is another ethical issue, and an interesting one, which always fascinates me, in that clearly, on the one hand, as you say, that keeping an animal in captivity, you could argue, isn't right, and it never allows the animal to actually live its natural life. I think zoos have improved a lot over the years, an awful lot of the best ones have, seem to give the animals more space, that it's never going to be able to totally replicate its natural life. On the plus side, if it is a good zoo and provides a good educational facility and tells people about the plight of animals, how they live in the natural, actually interests generations coming through to care about the animals, do you think, in your own view, is that a price worth paying then? Because it then educates generations coming through to actually care about species they might never see, like the lion, like the Siberian tiger, like the polar bear and the pangolin.
I think it's a really good question that you've asked. And so I'm only going to answer this as my opinion. So I don't want to get anybody else into trouble. So for me, getting the next generation to care is of paramount importance. Okay, so definitely it's hugely important. But in the modern age that we are, technology is everything. Okay, and I think that when you've seen as much suffering as I've seen in cages and in different facilities, etc., there is something that we should be able to put on the table now with holograms, with excitement, which the next generation is going to be more accepting and ready for, because it is what their generation is interested in, than what our generation and our forefathers were doing, which were animals in cages. I do believe where we are with technology, I mean, we've got people in space, for goodness sake. You know, does the next generation want to actually see an animal pacing in a cage? Or would they prefer to see a hologram where they could walk through it? Or, you know, I think there's a lot more we could do that would have a greater impact on the next generation. And at the same token, we can not let so many animals be put through not such a nice life. And remembering that you've then got the whole exotic pet trade, and that's another discussion for another day, okay? But that's generated because people want to pet a serval, or they want to have a bear. You know, is that what we want? Do we want people to have bears in a tiny little backyard that could potentially hurt somebody at some point in time? Or like it when it's a cub? I mean, I think there's a massive otter craze, and, you know, like it when it's little, but when it gets big in teeth, what do you do then? And you shove it literally into a bottom drawer. You know, the ethics has to come into the play here. And I think the next generation, they are caring, and they need to. We need to move forward at their level, not what our forefathers did.
And I think, again, you hinted at before the sort of anthropomorphic side of things as well. And I was wondering whether that's something which comes into play with the pangolin, and that species like maybe polar bears, dangerous though they are, have that, have a sort of an anthropomorphic cuddly feel because they're furry, and ditto something like the giant panda again.
Yeah.
Look wonderfully cuddly and furry and whatever, and something which is seen as being scaly and perhaps a bit more prehistoric and whatever, even though it's an iconic species and an incredibly caring species as a parent, and as you say, isn't seen as sort of, hasn't got the cuddly factor. Is that something you always have to fight against with some of these sort of species?
I think it is, until people get to know. I mean, a pangolin is a very strong-minded individual, so their characters are just everything. I mean, they elude this amazing aura about them, so the cuddliness is kind of there, but in a different way. And so for me, I struggle with the fact that people don't think pangolins are cuddly, because I do. And particularly, you know, your smaller arboreal species like the white-bellied and the black-bellied, they are unbelievably beautiful. And the way that their tail, just, you know, everything about them is like liquid gold. So I think it's just getting to know the animal.
And of course, you have a curled pangolin as the logo.
Yes, I do. Mm. Yes, so I chose the pangolin as a logo because from our Shona culture, only a chief can decide and receive a pangolin. So I wanted to honour my father, Tiki Highwood, and his memory, and that's why I chose the logo of a pangolin for our logo. Never thinking that I would be doing pangolin, just adding that into the whole discussion.
It's terrific. Well, the best of luck with the talk. That the foundation itself, we should say, is a broader than just pangolins. Again, it fights for basically conservation issues worldwide.
Yes, absolutely. We are involved with legislation and policy development within Zimbabwe. We work with governments in the different countries where we operate. You know, our ethos has always been working with governments. Like I've said before, governments are your key to making any choices, changes, and policy development going forward. So very important.
It's wonderful we do have people like you with a passion and a drive and energy to do this, because I think within any of this sort of work, that's exactly what you need, isn't it? You just have to have the belief and the drive and the constant energy to think change will come, even if it's sometimes at a glacial speed.
100%. Every single animal counts. Every pangolin that gets the opportunity not to be eaten and to get back into the wild, safe space, I mean, that's what makes you get up every day and do this job.
Well, listen, best of luck with the talk. It's lovely to see you over here on the Isle of Man. I hope that it goes well and we can raise awareness for this iconic species. And I must go and see one, I must admit, because I've seen the pictures and the videos and they are an amazing looking species. And you wouldn't instantly identify them as a mammal when you first off look, would you?
Yeah.
It'd be wonderful. Thanks ever so much for spending some time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.